This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. A very happy new year to you all. 2016 was a long one, full of political strife and national uncertainty, and yes, there may be more of that to come. But it's 2017 now, and we want to begin the new year with something that unites us. Laughter. And our sacred national tradition of making fun of ourselves, and especially making fun of our leaders.
We have had bitter, angry elections for 200 years, whether it was Jefferson versus Burr, Adams versus Jackson, Lincoln versus Douglas, Alien versus Predator. The point is, this is our thing, okay? In America, we get to pick who's going to ruin our country.
Well, that's Conan O'Brien's take on the election. This hour, we're going to channel some of that wit. We're taking a look back at some of our favorite conversations with comedians and the commentary they offer about the world we live in now. And there's no one better to start with than W. Kamau Bell. Bell is a self-described socio-political comedian and dad.
When me and my wife have kids, our kids are born, our kids are considered to be either mixed race or black. What are they not considered to be? Exactly. Everybody got that in unison. So by having a child with a white person, I've taken the possibility of another white person out of the mix. Do you understand what I'm saying? Yeah. I believe Malcolm X said, by any means necessary. Yeah.
That's a bit from Bell's Showtime comedy special, Semi-Prominent Negro. But W. Kamau Bell is probably best known for his Emmy-nominated United Shades of America, a comedic documentary series that runs on CNN. Bell describes it as a show about a black guy going places you wouldn't expect him to go, like Arkansas, at night, on the side of the road, in conversation with a fully hooded member of the Ku Klux Klan.
We are a white race. Okay. I'm proud of my race. I'm proud to be white. You proud to be a black man?
I am proud to be a black man.
Okay, that's good. You're a black man. You married a black woman?
I'm married to a white woman.
You know what the Bible says about racial marriage? An abomination of sin.
On the list of sins, where is interracial marriage? There's like murder, and is interracial marriage equal to that, or is it?
It'd be above because it's an abomination.
So it's worse than murder?
Yeah.
We spoke with Bell last October about comedy, race, and politics. And we began with this obvious question. Was he nervous recording that segment with the Ku Klux Klan?
It's funny. People ask me that all the time. Yes.
How could you not be, right?
I mean, I feel like it's very clear. I mean, I think people, that was the first episode, so I don't know that people had a real sense of what I looked like when I wasn't nervous. But I'm looking at that like, look at that guy. Doesn't he look nervous? But yes, I was nervous the whole time. There was times I thought it was a bad decision. There was times where it overwhelmed me and I like had to take a knee, Colin Kaepernick style, and just sort of back out of my feelings. Like I was just like overwhelmed with emotion and had to sort of like fight back some emotions so I could keep going.
Yeah, well, so I mean, because this is the thing about political comedy is that you're always going to be treading into territory which is by design provocative, uncomfortable, even scary at times. And I'm wondering if we could just sort of go back in time a little bit, back to what, 2012 or so, when Chris Rock tapped you for the FX show Totally Biased with W. Kamau Bell. I mean, tell us about that, because I'm wondering what you learned from working with Rock about doing this kind of comedy.
Oh, it's funny. I was just thinking about this. I was putting together the list of the 10 things I learned from Chris Rock, because I did learn a lot of things from him that were very sort of like real world applicable things as far as being in your career and also being a comedian. So, you know, I think the thing he said to somebody else about me when he was saying about what do you like about Kamau, like as far as this, he's like, I don't know, which is sort of his answer to everything. But he said he can portray anger with a smile. And I thought that like, oh, is that what I'm doing? I think I learned what my sort of like what my strength is through working with him. Like the thing, because I sort of was just, I'm a comedian in the world trying to do things. But when Chris Rock says, I think I can see a TV show in you, you know, he was really good at like, you know, it was sort of a Mr. Miyagi Daniel-san situation where he really pulled me apart and put me back together. And I certainly am a much better comedian because of the time I spent with Chris Rock. Like, how to always look for jokes. I think Chris is really clear about like, if you're talking, there's an opportunity for a joke. Like, so, yeah. And which I just demonstrated by not having a joke at the end of that sentence. But, you know, there's always, so he doesn't believe in like long setups. He believes in like, if you're setting things up, find jokes on the way to the joke and then find jokes after the joke. So I think I've become a lot more scientific about it since I worked with him.
Well, let's listen to a little bit about how that played out in the FX series, Totally Biased with W. Kamau Bell. Sadly, it only ran for a couple of seasons, but here's a clip from the show from 2013.
This week, the state of Mississippi shocked everybody by passing a landmark piece of progressive legislation.
148 years after the Civil War, Mississippi finally ratified the 13th Amendment. That's abolishing slavery.
Oh, and I know what the 13th Amendment is. I keep a copy of it in my wallet in case I ever to go south of Maryland. And if I lose that, I have a tattoo of it on my chest.
That's from the FX series, Totally Biased with W. Kamau Bell. Now that show also had like kind of man on the street moments too, right?
Yeah, that's funny. I'm having a little bit of a memory thing. I was like, I hardly remember saying those words that you just played, but yeah, like it was. There was. I mean, if anything, the United States of America show is an outgrowth of the Man on the Street stuff. The feedback I got from people who watched Totally Biased is that their favorite stuff I did was actually the Man on the Street stuff, and I'd never done anything Man on the Street before that, and so for me it was like, oh, this is, again, listening to other people who are smarter than you. Is that what I'm good at? Okay. And so United States of America is the extension of that.
Yeah. And did you one more question about Chris Rock here, because, I mean, he's such a huge figure in the world of political comedy or comedy in general. I mean, were there moments where you were sort of cutting your teeth in terms of, like, how to handle politically charged moments in the Man on the Street segments where he gave you some good advice about how to handle that?
You know, I think the best advice he gave me was really like, you have to get in there and mix it up with the people. And I think I'm naturally an introvert and a shy person. And so going out and stopping people and talking to them to me seems like, I don't want to bother people while they're living their lives. But the thing he said is like, when you get out there and mix it up with the people, they will really get to know you and respect you. And that has 100% been true. And I think a part of me, you know, now, before Totally Biased, if there had been like a big commotion on the streets, you know, if I'd been involved in that, I would have run away from it. But now, like with the microphone, I'm like, when people get loud and aggressive, I'm like, yes, this is what we want. Like, I sort of lean into these moments, which has actually helped with United States of America. Like, there's times where I feel myself wanting to pull back, but I feel the comedian in me going, no, keep going further.
Yeah. So let's talk a little bit more about United Shades of America. Runs on CNN, Emmy nominated. Tell us about what that show has sort of done for you and your career. Because I think people, it's fair to say that at least after the first season of it, that may be the thing you were best known for.
Yeah, I'm really happy about that, because for a while it was being best known for a show that had been canceled. So. I'm really happy that got shifted to being known for success. I'm totally proud of Totally Biased. But, you know, I think that, CNN has Bourdain, they have Morgan Spurlock, they have Lisa Ling, and so they had already sort of had these shows by people who are already established brands, and I'm really happy about the fact that that the show that we created with United States of America fits right into that and extends the brand in a different way, and that I'm not the junior member of the team anymore.
Right.
Thanks to the Emmy nomination, I'm like one of the people. Like, I ran into Bourdain at the Emmys. We'd never actually met before. And he was just like, we got to do something together. And I was just like, the CNN person was like, that sounds good. Inside, I'm like, yippee.
Well, let's play a clip here from United Shades of America. This is an episode in which you take on the problem of gentrification. And you're in Portland, Oregon. And you're talking with Pastor Don Fraser. Here it is.
When you see a community just overrun, and you grew up in it, and it changes so fast that you just about get whiplash from it, it does impact you.
And when you say overrun, how do you mean by overrun?
Well, the highest value in our community, African-American community, is relationship. And we used to sit on one another's porches and talk, watch each other's kids. And all of a sudden, you have developers coming in with big money who are buying all this property up and changing it. So the whole community is uprooted and dispersed and displaced.
That's Pastor Don Fraser speaking to W. Kamau Bell on the show United Shades of America. That moment that we picked there is it's pretty serious. It's not funny. And so I'm just wondering, like, how do you know when to inject the comedy?
You know, I think that, you know, I think there was a lot of worry about that when we first started, because I think the show, when the show was pitched, it was pitched as a more broad reality type show, like, you know, sort of me getting into wacky adventures, I think, or whoever. They hadn't thought about me yet, but getting into, and I came in and sort of was like, well, if I want to do this, I want to do it my way, which thankfully the production team was Jimmy Fox, who's the head of production, was great about. And so I've really gotten less and less worried about how to do the funny, just knowing that we will figure out a way to make it funny. I'd rather have a good conversation with somebody and figure out a way to sort of frame it in a way that maybe had something, but I'd rather have the good conversation. And also, when people know you respect them, because even in that conversation with Pastor John Fraser, it ends with him talking about collard green scones, and we laughed about that. So you can sort of, when people respect you and think you're really there to listen and pay attention, you can make jokes about things that are painful because they know you're doing it respectfully.
Yeah, so we're living in a time where people look to smart comedians to really sort of help us think about and talk about the political intensity of our lives at the moment. And I want to talk to you about that in a second. But let's back up. I mean, what first pulled you into comedy?
I mean, I think, you know, I was a comedy nerd before that was a thing. Like, now people talk about comedy nerds. It's this sort of group of people who follow comedy the way some people follow sports. And I was doing that before that there was a name for it. My mom said she could get me to do anything if she promised to let me stay up and watch Saturday Night Live. So I was just like, you know, I would have had trading cards of the cast of Saturday Night Live if that existed. Like, I was, you know, I thought Eddie Murphy was only like, you know, was like a friend of mine. You know, it's just like I was really connected to it and grew up really thinking that comedy was the second best thing to being like an actual superhero. And so it was just something that I was always pulled into. And then in my life with my mom and my dad, like, we talked about race and racism a lot. So it was just sort of eventually, as I grew up in comedy, I sort of like put these two things together.
Well, so in your Showtime special, Semi-Prominent Negro, you do talk about your mom a little bit. And, you know, you talk about her as, you know, being an intense, passionate person when it came to talking about race. And there's sort of a little like throwaway line you have about her having gone trying to get a PhD but wasn't allowed to get it from whatever school she was going to. Is that true?
Yeah, I mean, as far as I know it to be true, that's the story that she has told me and that we've talked about, and that's been one of those family stories that get passed around, that she was at Stanford and she wanted a PhD in African-American literature. And at that point, they didn't feel like that was actually a field of study, which is only, we're talking about the early 70s, basically. And so she withdrew. I mean, many people think my mom is a doctor and many people think she's a professor. And it's just like, no, she's just a really smart black lady. Like, but she doesn't actually have the letters behind her name that that people assume she has.
Yeah. Well, speaking of smart and intelligent black women, I want to play a clip from your Showtime, your most recent Showtime comedy special, Semi-Prominent Negro. And it's about the process that you go through, you and your wife go through, when thinking about a preschool that's right for your daughter.
Just so you know, at this preschool, we don't focus kids on, like, letters and numbers and learning right away. We just want them to experience play. It's like, thank you, lady, because I'm going to take my daughter the f*** out of here. Because I don't know if you noticed, but I'm raising an African-American lady baby. And they need to be as smart as possible, as early as possible, because they start way behind the starting line of the other babies. So if they don't get all their knowledge right away soon, then suddenly they're going to be behind their entire lives. But I thank you for giving us a tour. This preschool is clearly for white male babies, all right?
That's W. Kamau Bell from his Showtime special, Semi-Prominent Negro. What I love about that clip is that you kind of you hear the audience with you, they're laughing, and then there's a ooh, and they're not sure if it's supposed to be funny. I mean, like, you're really pushing them there.
I think it's easy for me to push because I'm talking about my kids. I feel like if I don't get my kids back, I can't expect other people to. So I feel like it's very easy to lean into that joke and just be like, this is exactly how I feel, and I don't care how you feel because it's too important for me to worry about your feelings. I'm worried about my kids' feelings.
So how do you decide, or when did you decide that you were going to talk? Because you do talk really honestly about your kids, about your marriage. You're in an interracial marriage. And you know, why did you decide to bring that into your comedy?
I think it's just a part of sort of navigating this journey. I think that there was a point when I was single where I don't think I was a comic who talked about his girlfriend or had girlfriend jokes in that way. And a lot of comics did. But then once you get married and have kids, it takes up so much of your life that it sort of seems, as a comic, you're just observing your life. And when so much of my life is caught up with my family, it seems like I'm just skipping material if I don't talk about it. And also, the thing I want to do is try to, like, a lot of people have jokes about kids, but I want to put my lens on the jokes about kids. I'm not just going to do the jokes about how my kids are adorable, and they are, but I'd want to do jokes about how I see them, how I see their lives playing out in this world, and how I'm trying to, me and my wife are trying to help them get ahead of the game.
Yeah. Well, there's one more clip I want to play from your Showtime special, and it's a really, it's hilariously political one, where you talk about how there's a unique way that President Obama can speak to the black community, and use an example of the fact that he sang Amazing Grace at the funeral of Clementa Pinckney, who was one of the people murdered in Charleston, South Carolina in the church massacre. It's not really a moment where you'd think one could find comedy, but you do, because you talk about how no other politician could sing Amazing Grace the way Obama did. So let's listen to the clip.
Bernie Sanders ain't singing, you know what I'm saying? You're like, oh, amazing. Oh, you know the words. Oh, capitalism. Big banks. Hillary Clinton ain't singing. She walk up there like, Bill, get out of here. I got it, Hillary. Amazing Grace. Call me. But Barack started singing, going into like the next verse, and there's a gospel choir that appeared out of nowhere. And a black guy playing organist fell out of the sky, just playing it. It's like a revival meeting. He's singing Amazing Grace. Like, oh my God, this is so black! I was like, touch me, don't touch me, touch me, don't touch me. Look at me, don't look at me, I can't take it anymore. I'm gonna miss you, Obama! Good night, everybody.
What do you make of the fact that you're doing your comedy at this political moment? And as I was saying earlier, so many people do look to comedians to help us navigate and make sense of and, you know, deal with this world that we're living in. Is that a place that you want to be?
I mean, it's a place where I am. It's certainly there's a different amount of pressure during sort of election season than there is during just regular old times. You feel like I'm doing shows on this tour, and if I go on stage and don't say the words Donald Trump for an hour, people are gonna be like, are you not paying attention to the news? So they're currently the news gives you homework assignments. So there is a sense, but also I think a lot of it with my audience is like we're also sort of looking together to come together to have like a place to mourn collectively with what's going on in the world, and sort of I'm there to sort of like help us get through these moments. So I honor it. I'm happy about it. But sometimes I go on stage going, I have no idea what to do here. Let's figure it out together.
W. Kamau Bell is a comedian and host of the CNN show United Shades of America, which will return for season 2 this spring. We spoke with him last October. When we come back, stand-up comic Cameron Esposito.
You guys, when a baby comes out, it has a full head of hair. Which means if you reverse that process right before that mom gave birth to that baby, she had a full head of somebody else's hair inside of her body. And I don't feel comfortable with that. I don't think any of us feel comfortable with that. We will throw away soup if it has one hair.
Stay with us. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.
Make them laugh, make them laugh. Don't you know everyone wants to laugh? My dad said be an actor, my son. But be a comical one. They'll be standing in lines for those old honky-tonk monkey shines. Now you could study Shakespeare and be quite elite. And you could charm the critics and have nothing to eat. Just slip on a banana peel, the world's at your feet. Make them laugh, make them laugh, make them laugh.
Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're spending this hour listening back to some of our favorite conversations we've had with comedians. Before the break, we heard from W. Kamau Bell on why, after the election season, he's choosing laughing over crying. And in that vein, we're going to talk now about the brand of bravery displayed by comedian Cameron Esposito. Esposito is known for tackling LGBTQ topics, from gay marriage to sperm donors to stereotypes of gay women, and she's not afraid to confront those who disagree with her. For example, there's a bit where she talks about being heckled. She was on stage when someone yelled out at her, "You look like a woman that doesn't sleep with men," to which Esposito replied,
"I look like a woman that doesn't sleep with men because I am a lesbian." And that's one of the biggest parts. And if you're a lesbian, you're not bummed about it. I cannot tell you this strongly enough. Like, this look, this is on purpose. To attract women.
Cameron Esposito has been named a comic to watch by the New York Times, and her show Take My Wife, starring Esposito and her real-life spouse Rhea Butcher, was picked up for a second season last month. We spoke with her back in November 2015, and we started with that heckler and how she deals with them.
I think it's a part of comedy. People assume that it's a part of comedy, and if you assume that, you are right. It's part of it. I'm a little bit smiley on stage and, like, kind of physically small. So, like, I'm not scary, which can lead to two things. Number one, people might sometimes chat with me. So I feel like that's what I get a little bit more okay. than the, like, aggressive heckler that I was just talking about. Usually it's just like, I'm very drunk and I don't understand whether or not you're a television. And then you have to be like, I'm not a television. And I can actually hear what you're saying.
Yeah. But what that guy said is like the worst kind of like stupid stereotyping possible. Like the first thing he says is, you don't look like you sleep with men.
Well, right. So I think that actually the stereotyping is what's interesting to me about this is like, I don't mind if you stereotype me as looking like a lesbian because I don't think it's negative to be a lesbian. Also, I am a lesbian. So like if you assume that that's what I am, that actually helps me out. Because then I don't have to come out to you. We can just agree that if I'm wearing a vest and tie, that might be me indicating to you that you, a dude, should not buy me a drink. And then we can just talk about other stuff, like how cool action movies are. And so I'm trying to tell that to the world. What was weird is him saying it like he was insulting me, which is so strange that lesbians would think like that he would think that it would be an insult for me, a lesbian, to be called a lesbian. Oh, I'm going to get this lesbian by calling her a lesbian. I'm going to really get her with this one. And that's not, it's not an insult. But I will say also, you know, I have been doing comedy for about 15 years now. And so the span of my time doing comedy and also being a performer who happens to be queer has been kind of like the whole thing in terms of gay rights in this country.
Yeah, the kind of about face that a lot of the country went through. I mean, was your sexuality part of your comedy from the beginning?
So I started doing improv. Actually, I started here in Boston. I went to Boston College and I started doing improv there.
To study theology?
Yeah, I was a theology major at BC because I believed in learning about the things that are the most important to people, which is still actually, I believe, what I do. I just think it's like, the wine is a little different than in church, but otherwise I still think, I mean, I'm now an atheist. I no longer subscribe to any faith, but I think that the job that I wanted when I wanted to be a priest, which the Catholic Church also said that I can't. Right. I was just the Pope is going to be like, well, like, women can't, but, like, get in here, Esposito.
They haven't quite gotten that far
yeah,
yet.
You can. I thought for some reason I would be the exception. But I think it's the same job because it's about talking about what's important to you and trying to make people's lives better. At least that's what I think comedy is. And I think that's also the role of religion for
okay.
a lot of people.
So you were telling me how you began with improv, really.
So
before
in improv,
stand-up.
You can't really be out because I mean, you can be out personally, but on stage, your job is to be present in the character that you're in. And that character might be assigned by somebody else. And then the whole tenet of improv, the primary tenet is yes and. So you have to agree with what that person is saying. And so when I was doing improv, I had some distance from myself and my sexuality on stage because you're supposed to be a character that's not yourself. Mm-hmm. That is eventually why stand-up became appealing to me. Because I actually lived here in Boston like as Massachusetts was becoming the first state to legalize same-sex marriage. Like,
yeah.
I was there on the state house steps and watching people get married the first day, and it was really cool outside of City Hall. So I felt like I had this mission to be out and talk about it on stage because I was a performer, but I was getting up and like being a hippopotamus. That doesn't help anybody.
No.
Like, we should just talk about being. It's a great time to be able to talk about my life.
Okay, so a lot of stuff happened when you were at BC. I mean, like you're telling us, improv, and then transitioning to stand up, and then did you meet Amy Poehler then at BC?
So, Amy was in the same improv group that I was in 10 years prior.
Okay.
And so she was.
My date's all wrong. I'm so sorry.
No, that's okay. So she was on SNL.
I'm not saying that you look old, by the way.
And also, Amy Poehler doesn't look old.
No.
We're all young.
Okay.
Everyone's young. The whole world is young. We're all young people. We were just born. Everybody was just born. But she was in the group 10 years before I was. And I say that because when I was there, you know, like being a banana or whatever I was doing in improv, Amy was on SNL, and so it was like the first time that I saw the possibility of a career in the arts was really her. because I felt like this tangential connection. And she did come back to school one time while I was there to receive an award, and so I got to like casually meet her.
Uh-huh.
But it was just, she was my first exposure to like, oh, you could actually do this for a job.
Okay, and so now your connection with her continues, right? Because yeah. You're doing this new web series, She Said, with Amy Poehler's group, Smart Girls.
Yes.
That is not the phrase I should have screwed up on.
You're okay. Please don't worry. You're being so hard on yourself.
It's been a long day.
You're doing a great job.
Oh, thank you.
We're going to get through this.
Okay.
Yes, Amy, who... What I love about Amy is that she's endlessly talented, but she also... is working, she's doing what I think comedy can do the best, which is she's just being an example to other people of a way that you can be. And Smart Girls is an example of, you can talk to young women about what it's like to be a woman and you can help them, because I think that somehow there's been a distance that's been created between adult women and young women. Like, the people that make programming are often dudes, and so women aren't even in that room to talk about the kind of programming that would have helped them when they were younger, or yeah. I mean, obviously now. And I say younger because the Smart Girls demographic is like 13 to 20.
Well, we've actually got a little bit of tape from the first episode
awesome.
Of She Said. And here you are. You're talking with Rhea Butcher. And she's also your co-host of the series. And you're talking with her about your first visit to the gynecologist.
When I was 16, I remember my mom first introduced the idea, and I think she even made an appointment for me, but I didn't go. I like sat in the parking lot and cried because I was really nervous. I didn't know what was going to happen in there, and I thought it would hurt, and so I just didn't go in. And then I didn't go until I was in my early 20s, which wow. is a lot of years to worry about it.
So you're really just kind of being frank and honest and just demystifying something that, until I guess you go through it, is kind of this weird mystery for a lot of people.
Absolutely. I went to a Catholic high school that did not have a sex ed program. So, and this is true, our sex ed was that we watched a videotape of an abortion in class. That was the whole thing. That was our whole sex ed. We watched
really?
A videotape of an abortion in class, and then a priest stood there and was like, don't have sex with your boyfriend. And then I was like, I don't even want to.
Problem solved.
Problem solved.
Wow.
But I think that a lot of women are actually in that position, you know, mm-hmm. where it, and you could even go to a school that has a great sex ed program. It depends on who's teaching it. And I don't think that these huge topics should be left to chance like that, which is why I believe so strongly in making this show, because we did, you know, research, and this was vetted by all the women at Amy's company, and we had people check, so just to make sure that we were saying the right things and being responsible while also sharing our experience, so that women that are about to make their first appointment with the gynecologist aren't walking in freaked out of their minds, which yeah. is what was happening for me.
That's comedian Cameron Esposito. We spoke with her in November 2015 about her web series, She Said. Her TV series is Take My Wife, which she stars in with her real-life wife, comedian Rhea Butcher. When we come back...
I don't believe in preparing. I personally don't really like preparers. They're annoying people generally. Like, you know, what's like, hey, I really prepared for this. Well, you're a coward. You know, why don't... Where's your sense of adventure?
Host of the WTF podcast, Mark Maron. Stay with us. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're starting 2017 with some levity, looking back at a few of our favorite conversations with comedians, from the political jabs of W. Kamau Bell to the cultural commentary of Cameron Esposito. We've looked at how players in comedy are interpreting the times we live in. We're going to end this hour revisiting a conversation with a comedian who thinks deeply about how we use comedy and where it comes from, Mark Maron. Marin has been a stand-up comedian for decades and had his own IFC show, Marin, that lasted 4 seasons before its series finale last summer. But Marc Maron is best known for his podcast, WTF with Marc Maron, featuring long-form interviews with celebrities, comedians, artists, even President Obama. We can't explain what WTF stands for, but I'm going to guess that you know. Maron records the podcast in his garage in Los Angeles. He spoke to WBUR's Deborah Becker about the podcast last September, and he started with why he thinks it's been so popular, given that each episode is over an hour.
If you have a conversation that flows and is engaged, why wouldn't people listen? I don't know where that lack of faith came from. And just to let things pace out as they would in a conversation is something I think that people are maybe craving even in their own life. I mean, I seem to think there was a time, at least when I was younger, where, and then again, I chose a line of work that afforded me a lot of time to sit around restaurants and diners and comedy clubs talking to people. But, you know, walking around and engaging with another person for sort of free form, long conversations about whatever was a tremendous way to spend a day.
And do you sort of approach it with the thinking, I want to talk to that person because I want to shed light on that person as a human being? I want to have a really good conversation, which of course everyone does who has those kinds of conversations. But is it more about crafting a conversation? Is it more about getting to the person? Is it more topical? What's sort of your guiding principle when you're thinking of who you want to talk with, if you have one?
A lot of times it's like, you know, what's that guy been doing?
Right.
You know, or what is she up to? Or what does her life look like? Or what, you know, what are they, you know, where'd they come from? I don't, you know, I'm not out to sandbag anybody or make anybody look bad. I'm usually out to sort of fulfill my own need to connect with people. And sometimes that works out and sometimes it doesn't. But ultimately, I'm looking to connect with them as people. And I think if anything happens in that garage that people really register when they're listening is, you know, people we grow to respect or idolize or appreciate their work in a general way because of movies or television or writing or directing or whatever they do, you know, our relationship with them is sort of not human. It's you know, we appreciate the work and we hear gossip or we think we know the person or we get an idea of them. But what happens when they come in there, you know, it's hard to hide for an hour. And and even if you're hiding, maybe that's a facet of your personality. So what the conversations become are sort of, you know, portraits of these people, hopefully emotional portraits of people in conversation at that time that I talk to them. And that's the best thing that can happen. It's not a matter of information, really.
Mm. You know, last year you spoke with Lorne Michaels from Saturday Night Live, and loyal listeners of WTF know how your meeting with Lorne Michaels decades ago haunted you, really. Now, how did you feel about that interview, and how do you feel now afterward?
I was happy that he was able to sort of address that memory of mine. You know, I had to get some closure on that. So I appreciated the fact that, you know, I went through my memory of that and he clarified things from his end or what he thought at that time. And I have to take his word. And that was definitely very helpful. And the feeling I got after mythologizing this guy and putting him up on a pedestal and assuming things about his power in show business and, you know, his power over that show, is that what I found very humanizing and almost humbling was that, you know, he's a guy that goes to that building and goes to work every day. And that to me was sort of a revelation.
So you got to feel that he was a little bit more human, and that made you feel better about what had happened years
ago?
Yeah,
man. I wasn't mad at him. And, you know, if anything, I don't think I was ready for that show, and I don't think that his decision was wrong. And, you know, and I was sort of cocky, and I had my own ideas about myself. So, of course, I'm going to kind of, you know, swagger through my own rendition of what happened for, you know, half my life and make him a villain. Yeah, I was happy he remembered it. And I'd like to believe he was trying to help me. And I'll take that. Whether at that moment he was or not, I'll accept the older Lorne being gracious and
paternal in a way.
I want to talk about your time in Boston. Mm-hmm. You were here, and it was here in Boston where you and Louis C.K. met in the 80s, right? He tells a story in the 2010 interview about seeing you at Catch a Rising Star and saying he didn't love you so much on stage at that time. What do you think about when you look back on your time in Boston?
And then he saw me washing dishes at the Coffee Connection. He's like, oh, that guy's all right. Yeah, I mean, that was right upstairs, too. Well, you know, I went, you know, there's a lot of different times in Boston. You know, I was, I went to college at Curry College out in Milton and for my freshman year, and that was that. And then BU. And then after college, you know, going to L.A., you know, having the first round of horrendous drug engagement, you know, after less than a year in L.A., you know, I ran back to Boston to sort of reengage and start comedy over. And there's so many different phases of me in Boston. Mm. And I got to know New England very well because when I started working as a comic in 1988, after I came in second in the WBCN comedy riot, I lost to Sue McGinnis. You know, I started working. There were all these bars and grills and bowling alleys and discos and hotels that, you know, they'd have comedy nights. So the way I paid my dues working as a comic outside of Catch a Rising Star, which was sort of like a salon compared to the actual work you had to do, was you would get directions. You'd go to the office of the Boston Comedy Company. You'd go and Nina would give you a map. You know, and you're working for $75 and you're opening on a two-man show, a two-person show where the opener would do a half hour and the headliner would do 45. You're driving, you know, to Cranston, Rhode Island to perform at a bowling alley bar, or you're driving up to Mother Shapiro's up in Burlington at the ski area, or you're going out to Pancho Villa's in Leominster to perform under a disco ball.
But I'm not hearing real happiness to be quite honest.
I don't know how I did it, Deb. I don't know who that kid was. He was aggravated. He was, you know, socially different than most of those audiences. You know, I was this angry Jewish guy. I don't know how I did it, but I did it. You know, I once drove like 8 or 9 hours to Machias, Maine to open for a hypnotist at a college. So, but it was all I wanted to do.
You know, it just reminds me of something. There was an interview that with Billy Crystal, and he told you that he had a mantra about his career. Don't settle in. You said yours was hide the hate. Yeah, I'm wondering, like, did that kid get in the way for a long time, do you think? And you were able to resolve things that allowed you to have success? Or what happened there?
You know, my hate was a sort of, you know, a self-hatred that was projected that, you know, I assumed that the audience wouldn't like me, you know, always. I assumed walking out on stage that it was going to be trouble from the get-go. But, you know, I was also, you know, a Jewish kid that grew up with parents from New Jersey who liked Buddy Hackett and Don Rickles and Jackie Vernon and, you know, Woody Allen. You know, so somewhere along the line, my nature had sort of been steamrolled by, you know, my fear and my contempt. It took me a long time to find myself in my own body with my own heart and mind connected to what I was doing. So, settling was never really a choice for me.
Right. Why so much fear and contempt?
Well, I mean, I don't know. That's a good question for anybody, isn't it?
Yeah,
I mean,
it is.
I don't know why I chose comedy to find myself. You know, it seems like the most adverse thing to do that. Mm. You know, but there was something about being seen, being witnessed. You talk to a lot of comics and they go up there, you know, wanting to be loved. I think I had that, but I was going to fight it if it was coming to me. Mm. Which I think makes me a little different.
In an interview with Alan Alda, he asked you if you have kids, and you said no. When you're 52 years old and you don't have children, someone's right. What did you mean by that?
I said that? Well, look, you know, it just wasn't, you know, I've been married twice, and I don't know, you know, if it's unhealthy or healthy or what, but whatever my parents did, however I brought up, I have a certain amount of anxiety and self-centeredness. I never thought about it.
Yeah, I mean, it's hard for me just with cats. You know, I panic, you know, if they're not eating. I don't feel that there's a void in my life. Maybe I will another time, but I'm not wired that way, and I'm okay with it.
You decided to end your IFC show, Marin, after four seasons this year. Why is that?
Well, how many do you need to do? You know what I mean? I don't need the money. So the truth was is that we had told all the stories, and, you know, we did three seasons, you know, that were directly based on my life, and one sort of season that was a cautionary tale and sort of a darker exploration of the possibilities of, addiction and losing success. I felt like we had a nice end to it, and I thought the story was nice, the arc was nice, and I loved the way it ended. And I don't need to do things I don't want to do.
Well, I want to just talk a little bit more about that dark cautionary tale, where in season four, when a back injury leads to an addiction to painkillers, it's a big deal right now nationally. But why did you want to get into that on the show, and is that something that you worry about personally? Right after 17 years of sobriety yourself, is that right?
Right. Well, I mean, I feel pretty grounded in my sobriety, but certainly, you know, being a guy who does recovery, and you do see it happen, and that's usually how it happens. So to sort of depart from my real life narrative a bit and explore that was good for me to see how easy it happened, and also it was interesting to go explore the idea of, like, you know, having something and then having absolutely nothing. The whole life of an addict, when that happens, no matter when it happens and what happens to your life, is profound and horrible. I just wanted to honor that somehow. I wanted to, you know, why build this world where I just podcast and, you know, have problems with women and whatever? We didn't need to honor that. You know, we were on IFC. We could do whatever we wanted. So when the idea came, you know, that I relapse, I was like, this is amazing. Like, I didn't even know if I was going to do a fourth season. And then I sort of had this epiphany that if we can do it where it's like three different shows where, you know, I'm strung out and I got to get clean, and then I got to figure out how to transition into life, and then I change my life drastically. Like, if we could break it down like that, it would be a very challenging and exciting thing to do. But for me, it was an exploration of something that is very possible. I'm not personally afraid of relapsing, but I am, you know, deeply afraid of drugs and alcohol, and I know in my heart and my mind that I can't do them. But again, you know, it happens. I see it happen. I see cats with 20 years sober, you know, decide that they can, you know, try it again, or they get strung out because of an injury.
Mm. So is sobriety still a struggle for you, or what do you think is the key for you to being successful?
No, sobriety is not really a struggle. I just make sure that, you know, I do a bit of the work around it, you know, staying, like, I don't have any desire to drink or do drugs, but, you know, I get a little crazy sometimes. So I got to check in with the secret society, you know, and I still actively, you know, engage with that. You know, I talk to sober people all the time. I have sober friends. You know, I have a sponsor that I talk to. The key to success for me, I don't know. You know, it came around the side. I didn't know. When I started the podcast, I didn't think it was going to happen. I just needed to stay active.
Mm. Now, I've read that you don't like talking about politics, but you did mention on the podcast that talking about politics on stage and hearing in yourself a tone of intensity and anger was one that you used in your stand-up when you were younger. But, you know, we're also in the midst of a contentious presidential election. Is it tough to stay away from politics or not really?
I've been doing a bit on stage. You know, I don't want to use the podcast that much for a platform of that. But I've been talking about politics for a bit of my act. I try to be as empathetic as possible to those that are wrong-minded. And but see, then it becomes an opinion anyways. I just find it all very embarrassing for a lot of reasons, and very frightening for other reasons. But I do have a certain amount of faith in democracy and humanity. I'm not as cynical as people think, but I'm not thrilled with the environment of information, if that's a nice way to put it, that, you know, there's this capacity now for people to be so fragmented because we really share so little of the same information that, you know, is even, you know, necessarily journalistic.
You know, you talked about this polarization with President Obama when you spoke with him last year. I think there was a lot of that in there about the fragmentation of media and sort of the echo chamber that people can get themselves into without really getting any information. Was that what was that interview like, and what was your ultimate goal, do you think, in talking with him?
My goal was to talk to the guy. You know, my research was very specific. I read his first book before he had presidential aspirations, certainly, which was a book about his struggle with, you know, his purpose in life and his own identity, racially and otherwise. And I thought, well, that guy's got to still be in there. And it would be interesting to talk to him. I knew that it was going to be a risk to stay away from politics, but I had an hour. And his agenda, as he stated on the show, was to get people involved in politics. And I learned that during the show. I mean, obviously, I knew that he made a choice to talk to me for a reason. He was looking for an audience of a certain type, and it was my audience, and the event was the event. But I found that, you know, very quickly I was, you know, calling him man and, you know, and finishing his sentences for him. So there was a comfort level that was achieved, and I'll have to give him the credit for that. And what I like about him a lot is that he's not the guy, you know, if you walked into a party with a lot of people and Barack Obama was there before he was president, you know, he's not going to be the guy that everyone's, you know, rallying around to listen to stories. You know, he's not a raconteur. He's not a, you know, like he's not this obsequious, charming, handshaker. You know, he's a thinky guy. I mean, I would think that if you went into a room before he was president and he was there, you'd be like, is that guy okay? What's he thinking about? You know what I mean?
So do you think you would have had all of these successes if you hadn't started the podcast?
No way. Huh. No way. And yeah, it all came from that, you know, moment of desperation to do something without a plan, without any idea of how it would make money. I had no gigs to plug. There was no way to make money, but I knew I just had to keep talking and doing something. So it wasn't even a Hail Mary pass. It was just me avoiding slipping into the darkness in all that that implies. You know, the podcast really does better for me, you know, as a job than any of the other things at this point. So I'm being afforded the opportunity to really do everything I wanted to do as a young comic, you know, which is television and a bit and have an audience as a comic. You know, it's not massive, but it's manageable for me, and it's better in that sense. So, you know, I do have fantasies of, it's weird. I do have fantasies of doing nothing.
Really?
Yeah.
You don't sound like you have a personality that could do nothing.
People say that, but I wonder. I mean, you know, nothing doesn't mean I won't be doing anything, but not like there. Like the beautiful thing about where I'm at now is that, you know, there are a lot of elements of my self-esteem have been sort of, you know, kind of filled in a lot of the holes there because of, you know, you work 20, 25 years at something. It's nice to connect and do something that people enjoy and get a lot out of and seems, you know, relevant to people. I like, hopefully I can begin to enjoy it because I still seem to make myself pretty crazy.
Oh, right. I wonder if it's almost difficult. Would you say, okay, is this it?
Well, that's not what I think. What I think is, like, you know, the other shoe's going to drop or I'm a fraud. Like, I know, like, there's no sort of like, yeah, I'm here. You know, I would welcome that for 10 minutes. For me, because of my anxiety and just the way I'm wired, you know, my brain would much rather be filled with panic and dread than excitement. And they're very similar. It's a very slight adjustment.
Comedian Mark Maron speaking with WBUR's Deborah Becker last September. Maron is the host of the podcast WTF with Mark Maron. That's it for today's special hour. Thanks for listening back to some of our favorite conversations with comedians with us. And because it's New Year's, let's just end with these words of wisdom from John Oliver.
Deep down, we all know the key to a successful resolution is not hard work and dedication. It's managing disappointment, and that's it.
Happy New Year. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.
The acquaintance be forgotten, never brought to mind. Should old acquaintance be forgot, and days old lang syne.